Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we will continue our ever-going exploration of the cultures of consciousness. This morning I got an email from Christopher Knowles, who's a friend of mine that does the excellent blog, The Secret Sun. If you're not aware of this, it's definitely worth checking out. And he was just pointing out an older entry he had done that he wasn't sure I'd ever seen, and it was really quite ingenious. What he did is dug out ancient mystery religion text, the Mithraic Liturgy of the Paris Codex, which has the description of a kind of mystery ritual from the days of the Mithraic mysteries and other mysteries where mystical experiences were created through a process of ritual and supernatural evocation and lots of esoteric ideas. And he simply wrote out all the chunks of the liturgy, you know, be gracious to me, O Providence and Psyche, as I write these mysteries handed down for gain. And then it goes on and goes through these experiences, and he's taken up by the gods, and he sees the gods. But what Christopher did is to link all of the quotations to wonderful images from science fiction movies and UFO lore. So he makes no claims. He doesn't draw any distinction. He doesn't say this means this, that when they talk about the visible gods will appear through the disk of God in this Mithraic liturgy, that of course they're actually talking about aliens and their flying discs. That would be too literalistic. And yet by juxtaposing this pop arcana of UFO lore with ancient mystery rites, he does something very interesting, which is to suggest both the continuity and the rupture that informs our quest today, or our fascination today, I should say, with the edges of consciousness, with the edges of spiritual experience, of mind itself. And so I'm it really, you know, set me going, because one of the things I like about The Secret Sun is that he looks at a lot of very fascinating kind of conspiratorial connections, looking at images and advertisements and television shows and weaving them together to suggest these larger kind of cosmic conspiracies. But he always does it with a sort of lightness, a kind of humor, or a kind of open-endedness, rather than that sweaty, bug-eyed conviction of so many people who deal with this kind of material. And for me, that difference makes all the difference, that there's some interesting challenge that people interested in these topics have of trying to, you know, walk a line, get close to the mystery, and yet stay on the edge of it as well, to keep things open, to keep things possible, to keep things from being sucked into a wormhole of obsessive underground conviction. And this was all going to be a lead-up today to our planned guest, who is Greg Bishop, a fellow that I have wanted to meet and talk to for a long time. Greg started the magazine The Excluded Middle in the early 1990s that I read voraciously back in the day, and he has done and continues to do a marvelous job of walking this line of tracking the mysteries, particularly ufology, but other forms of occult and psychedelic weirdness, and really moving into the space of these contemporary wonders while keeping one foot firmly on the ground, but not having the sort of generic kind of skeptic perspective as well. But unfortunately, it does not seem that Mr. Bishop is going to show up today. And so rather than cancel the show, Maja, my co-host, and I decided just to have a discussion about some of the topics we wanted to address today. So how does that sound, Maja? Can we do it?
That sounds awesome. I apologize for my voice. I know I sound like Tom Waits. I have a little bit of a frog in my throat.
It's actually not as bad as I thought it would be when you Skyped me about it. I assumed it would be more raspy. It's actually just it's sort of like a more like mature you. Like you sound like you're like an elegant, you know, 55-year-old woman at some esoteric party rather than the sprightly 30-something you are.
Well, that's good. I'm glad that it's not too scary.
So I know that, I mean, we might as well just plunge right into it. We're just going to be talking today. You had a question and that you were going to ask Greg based on some of the stuff that you had, I think, read in The Excluded Middle. What was the topic that you were interested in?
I totally did, and this is kind of a topic that we talk about a lot, and certainly we've talked about it with each other, is, you know, going back to Aleister Crowley and Jack Parsons, which seems to be an inescapable subject matter if you do any kind of reading on the occult. But I had read in The Excluded Middle, there was this article that had been written about Aleister Crowley's kind of experiences with UFOs and aliens and how he had presented it in a certain way. And it relates to what you said in the introduction, actually, how if people keep their minds open and don't try to put these kind of experiences and materials into a kind of parameter or like explain it as something, but rather just look at it as a whole. Like you can have the Mithraic information and just look at it with an open mind and you can get a lot of information from it. Same with Aleister Crowley in this article. You know, there was some famous drawings that he did of these entities that look a lot like aliens. Have you seen any of those?
Yeah. I was actually just as you were speaking in the wonders of modern technology, I was just doing some searches just to find those images. And the drawing that you're talking about is the picture of I never know how you're supposed to pronounce it, but Iwass, AIWASS.
Exactly.
Who is the entity who supposedly dictated the Book of the Law, which of course is, you know, in some sense the most important writing that the logoreic Crowley ever produced. And so this channeled text, which, you know, is for all of its peculiarities, and you can definitely see the greasy fingerprints of Uncle Al all over the document, it nonetheless has packs quite a prophetic punch. I mean, not only is it a powerful piece of and disturbing in some ways piece of channeled religious writing, but it definitely has a sense of, though it appears in 1906, of really kind of foreseeing the century to come. And so it's really remarkable, even before you look at the image, when you see the sketch that Crowley did about 15 years later,
right,
of this entity. It looks strikingly like contemporary images of the grays, the sort of almond-eyed, bald-headed aliens that have sort of died down a bit in the popular consciousness, were all the rage, and especially in the 1990s. So it does suggest that there's a kind of UFO continuum that goes back earlier than the emergence of modern flying saucers and the associated imageries that's actually more detailed even than just the appearance of flying ships, but actually has these sort of entities where there's some kind of mysterious continuity.
Well, totally, and it ties into the esoteric connection as well, because correct me if I'm wrong, but the story goes when Aleister Crowley received the channel of this information, he was at one of the pyramids in Egypt, and he was there with his wife at the time, who was pregnant, I believe, and she's the one that actually channeled it when they were literally like standing like on the pyramid. So that like goes into the whole like Egyptian UFO thing. You could tie it in, because not only does he receive this crazy book of the law that is this kind of prophetic, amazing work, but he receives it at the pyramid in Egypt.
Well, great. Hey, look, I just found out that like some magical apparition emerging from a UFO on my desk, that Greg Bishop has indeed joined us. Greg, thanks for showing up here on Expanding Mind.
Hey, sorry I'm a little late. I had to get out of something at work, which I'm actually watching through the window here. So I might have to stop for about 2 minutes and about half an hour, but then I'm okay.
That's fine. You know, it's we're lax here. So with the topic of the conversation, we're just kind of, you know, wandering through the labyrinth of wonders that is fringe culture. And we were talking about the interesting links between Crowley and subsequently Parsons and the UFO lore. And we had been talking about IWAS and how it kind of resembles the gray and such. And I'm sure you have some interesting thoughts on this matter. How do you see the relationship between, you know, what would become later UFO lore and the thalamic current, so to speak?
I don't know. I tend to think people put more emphasis on it than maybe they should, but there are undeniable connections. I mean, 1947, when Crowley died, was a important year, ufologically certainly, because of Kenneth Arnold and whatever happened at Roswell and what's become of it. But as we know, when we're talking about the occult and about Western magical tradition, we don't talk specifically about logical connections. We talk about more of intuitive and emotional connections, and there's certainly a lot of those between Parsons, what he was doing with the OTO in California, the rocket work he was doing, some of the scientists he was working with, and whatever New Age was being brought about by working on these rockets, and Crowley doing what he was doing, and, you know, Kenneth Grant and all those people that came after. I've always thought that it was probably, not always, but recently I've thought it might be better to look at the UFO and mystery and the paranormal from an intuitive perspective or a non-logical perspective, because that seems to be the way it operates.
Well, that's one of the things we started off talking about, was actually how one engages this material, and the fine line or the kind of middle path is really a way I like to think about it, not uninfluenced by your idea of the excluded middle, where you weave together these facts, you recognize these phenomena, you understand that people have profound experiences and try to make sense of them, and yet at the same time you allow the poetic logic or the as you call it, the intuitive side of it to sort of shape your account, rather than trying to sort of fix everything down into facts, which leads to conspiracies, which often lead to very kind of down the rabbit hole ways of looking at the world.
Well, there's two sides of our brains. I mean, there's the creative, intuitive right brain side, and there's an analytical, fact-loving, scientific left brain side. And most people either live in one or either one of those areas most of the time, because that's how we categorize people and things. I mean, there are certain people who are able to live in both quite well, and there are precious few of those kind. I think there's a few scientists right now, and then a few people. I would actually say that Crowley was a psychologist, as well as being a practitioner and creator of many methods for explicating things that are in your psychology and things that you have to deal with personally, because ultimately it's you dealing with the outside world. So, you know, if there was some, you know, I can't think of any UFO researcher that's solidly got their foot in both worlds. I mean, I try to, but I'm not enough of a, you know, intuitive artist type or enough of a scientist type to really take it to a logical conclusion or to make a breakthrough, I don't think. Although I try, and there are others who are trying too. But I think that's where some of the answers will lie with UFOs and the paranormal, is somebody that's able to take the data but not worship it, and then take the seemingly unconnected, illogical pieces of high strangeness and connect them too in ways that aren't, you know, glaringly obvious to a logical mind. I think that might be where a breakthrough might be made in that area.
I think one step that I've seen is we had him earlier. We had him on the show earlier. Is George Hansen's work on the trickster and the paranormal? It's not everything you're talking about, but he struck me as someone who, while not a strict, you know, scientist in the sense of being a physicist or something, was quite aware of scientific method and the sociology of knowledge in the modern world, and had some really interesting ways of talking about that, the liminality that haunts these realms, the space in between that it sort of swallows up any purely rational approach, even as you clearly need to approach it that way. But I wanted to ask you, kind of personally, like, you've been interested in this stuff for many decades, probably since you were a kid. How have you changed in terms of your degree of either, you know, entering into periods when you were really believing, or getting really sick of it and just thinking it was all a bunch of hooey, or whether you've kind of maintained this sort of middle place in the years that you've tracked a lot of, you know, fascinating and discovered a lot of really interesting stuff?
Well, I think that I started out, obviously, like everybody, whether young or old, reading a lot of these books, a lot of the material, be it from a scientific viewpoint or anecdotal viewpoint, or maybe later more of the intuitive viewpoint, and thinking that a lot of this stuff was, you know, I think I was a basic ETH-er, extraterrestrial hypothesis. And then as time goes on, you discover people like John Keel and George Hansen and Valet and even people like Jim Brandon, if you know any of his books, Greg Little, and realizing that there's a lot more to it than just aliens from other planets. And I remember I've talked to Jacques Valet two or three times, I guess. And one time was at and this really affected me. I was at a scientific exploration conference, the SSE conferences that happen every year. This was in 2000, I think, 99 or 2000. I gave Jacques Vallée a copy of the excluded middle book. And then I asked him, I said, why aren't you interested in the UFO thing anymore? Why aren't you writing anymore? Why did you back off from it? And he said, because I wasn't learning anything anymore. And that's kind of how I feel when after you've been, not just me, but anybody that's been around it for a while, either you just start consuming the material like pornography, because it gives you a thrill, or you get to the point where you're looking a little bit further than that towards some possible answer, maybe rather than proving that there's aliens here, which is, I don't think is, I think that's a rabbit hole to me. More like proving or examining how we interact with the phenomenon and interact with the paranormal and interact with things that we don't quite have an explanation for or a box to put it in our mind. That's something that's quite overlooked too, I think, I think half of what's going on with UFOs and Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster and a lot of these mysteries, a lot of the things we think of as bedrock reality, if we're into this kind of stuff, is a result of our interaction with whatever the thing is and not what the thing is, if you see what I'm getting at.
Well, I think that's exactly it right there, and I think a lot of, like, what you're saying with people who can kind of straddle that scientific and then also intuitive thing, it's based on an experience that they had. And a lot of these interpretations and study into the material is because, you know, you maybe had a profound experience of a UFO or something unexplained and a mystery. And so part of, I think, any scientific endeavor should be, you know, trying to put some of those experiences into a parameter of discovery and try and find out what the truth of the matter is. And so I think a lot of these breakthroughs that happen are from people that, you know, will look at it from that perspective, but it kind of has to be based on an experience of the mysterious that they have, that they really kind of felt in their heart.
But I think at the same time, there's another dimension that Greg's also talking about, which is it's not just that there are these experiences, is that as people talk about them, and then as people write about them, and then as they research them, and then as a discourse develops, and people talk about it online, and conferences happen, and rivalry, you know, all of that process is also part of the mystery. Or rather, it's also part of what the meaning of the event is. So in a way, if you get too caught up with just thinking about what is the meaning of the UFO encounter, the close encounter of the third kind, what actually happened that day, you know, with Betty and Barney Hill, you're, in a way, you're kind of missing the larger ecological mystery, almost an ecology of information and media, as you enter into this stream and your world begins to change. I mean, it's a remarkable thing about the internet, especially when I meet people who are kind of interested in, you know, in whatever, oddities in general, but maybe they actually don't know anything about UFOs, or they've never looked at 9/11 conspiracy material, or, you know, any number of other robust kind of worlds. And you say, look, you know, you should just, like, go devote one, you know, night to just spending hours online. And you can feel yourself shift slightly as information begins to take on a different character, as networks begin to form, as sort of meta stories begin to organize any bits of information you have, and that process is part of what these mysteries is about. Is that kind of what you're talking about, Greg?
Well, yeah, in a way. And as you're saying that, I was reminded, to kind of put it in a few words, of I was taking a Buddhist class, a Dharma class, maybe 10 years ago. And we were talking about, you know, how do you learn? How do you learn, I don't know, spiritual truths? How do you learn anything? How do you learn anything that really sticks with you? And the point is not to either hear about it once or look at it for one night or whatever. You can't have a breakthrough unless you, and this sounds old-fashioned, I guess, but you can't really have a breakthrough in anything until you've become so saturated with the information that things that weren't apparent by just hearing about them or reading about them or hearing a lecture about them come to you. You make that discovery yourself, whatever it might be. It might be, you know, always useful to you. Whether it's useful to other people is another thing. If it's useful to other people, great. But the fact of just sitting with the material for so long and having to go through the same journey that everybody else has, but then what you do with it is where the gold lies. But you can't just download all the information immediately and then expect to have any kind of understanding. You might have to sit with it for months or years or whatever until these hidden patterns start to reveal themselves to you. And if they hold up, maybe it's something you can communicate to with other people. Maybe you've got something.
That's a wonderful way of putting it. It really I've been thinking about that a lot in a more general sense, not just about these paranormal topics, but just the way people are encouraged, maybe more in our society now because of the kind of information glut and how people use the internet. I don't know, but maybe it was always this way, that just sort of feigning knowingness is sort of like a pervasive disease, where you sort of, you know, you get some information and you're able to kind of repackage it a little bit and then present it as something that you know, but it introduces this kind of hollowness. And it's actually rare to find people who have sat with things long enough, have risked getting bored with material or getting disenchanted with material and stuck with it for whatever reason long enough that something genuinely new happens or something genuinely personal happens. I mean, maybe all you can ever get, you know, from somebody who's gone through the hall of mirrors of the UFO phenomena at the end of the day is one person's particular story of going through that zone.
That's what I mean. I mean, if you're always, well, not always, but a lot of people are going to have personal revelations about it. I think probably 90% of the time the personal revelations are pretty much useless to everybody else. It doesn't mean it's useless to you. It should always be useful to the person that it's happening to. But every once in a while, like you said, with somebody like Hansen or with Kiel Valet, who else? God, there's a few others. These events and this experience will coalesce into something that is meaningful for other people and provides a stepping stone or a place of meaning or whatever. This isn't to say that you can't have an enlightening experience with almost no experience. That happens too. I mean, that was the Buddhist thing I was talking about. Some people get enlightened right away. Hmm. Nobody knows why. They have it. But most people have to follow a path. It's just the way it works. That's the way human minds work. And if you can come to some great revelation early on and communicate that to people. Colin Wilson did this really early in that book called The Outsider, if you've heard of that.
That's a great book.
He's somebody that in his 20s had a pretty good idea of what he was doing, where he was coming from, and what he wanted to say and how to say it. I think that's rare, but it's also you should not discount that. I think my late friend Mac Tonies had that.
Who is that? I don't know.
Mac Tonies. He wrote a book called The Crypto Terrestrials. He died last year. Actually, the anniversary is in about 10 days. Last year on October 10th, his parents found his manuscript that he was working on. Sent the rest of it to his publisher, and then it was published about 4 or 5 months ago. It basically takes the ideas of John Keel and a bunch of ufologists and pushes it into a new realm, saying that here's a theory. Why don't we consider the theory, although it's been considered before, but seriously consider the theory that whatever is making this UFO thing happen for us and putting things in the skies or on the ground or in our bedrooms, whatever we see, might have something to do with something that lives on this planet and is very much home on this planet rather than other planets. And, of course, that's been pushed before, but he goes into it in great detail. And the guy was 35 when he died, or 36, I'm sorry.
It's a lesson to us all to get going on our great works. You know, you don't know how long you're going to be around for. So we look forward to asking you some more questions, but we're going to take a brief break. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Greg Bishop, Excluded Middle Mastermind.
To PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach. So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
With Sierra Club Radio. Tune in Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com to hear interviews with green authors, activists, politicians, celebrities, and more.
Houston, we have a problem.
Christiane Brown. In today's 24-hour news cycle, most people get about a minute of real truth. Not on the Solution Zone. Every week, I bring in America's best-known activists, bloggers, authors, and politicians to uncover the hidden issues that help separate the truth from the spin.
The Solution Zone with Christiane Brown, every Wednesday at 3 on Progressive Radio Network.
Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind. Today we're talking about UFO mystical experiences with Greg Bishop. Me and Eric Davis are chatting about it. And Greg, it's very interesting to me that there is this kind of correlation, as you were mentioning earlier, about that kind of mystic experience or the experience of the outsider and how that relates to like UFO culture and those kind of experiences, or even like Eric said, going over the UFO material, you can have that kind of a mystic experience or a feeling of connection to the material, even just from reviewing it on the internet. Do you have any thoughts, or have you had any experience yourself,
Hello?
Like a personal kind of mystical experience with the UFOs that kind of inspired you?
Were you asking me a question? I was away from the phone.
Oh. what do you want to say, Maja? Was it the what personal experiences have you had that have drawn you into the Hall of Mirrors?
Yeah.
Me?
Yeah.
I don't know. I just was interested in it from an early age, and I really haven't had any personal experience, although you know, that was a precipitating experience. But I have had experiences after that. I've never seen anything weird in the sky. A couple times, but not very close. So it's not very exciting. I have had some psychic-type episodes where, you know, that a lot of people have, where you expect something to happen and it happens. Or I had a glass explode in my hand once for no apparent reason.
Wow.
I had a predictive experience where I came home from a long trip, and as I turned the corner coming down my street, I thought, there's a package for me behind the front door inside the house. And I was thinking, how the hell could I get a package through the door into the house? And I opened the door fully expecting to see a package behind the door as I opened it, and there was. And I even knew it would be in a black bag. I just figured it just popped into my head. And I said, wonder how the hell somebody got a package into the house. Then my friend called me the next day. One of my friends said, did you get my package? I said, yeah, how'd you get it in the door? And he said, I stuffed it under the door where the weather stripping was. So he did. But the point was that I knew it was going to be there, and he didn't tell me. He didn't even tell me he was going anywhere or buying me anything. So, you know, stuff like that has happened to me, and I didn't discount it before, but like you said, when it happens to you, it just kind of drives the point home a little bit more that for all the poo-pooing that goes on with things that aren't explained yet by science and our logic, it doesn't mean that they don't, quote-unquote, exist on a personal level. I might have to be off the phone here for 5 minutes. Not really anything
okay.
I can do about it. Can I call you back?
Yeah. Are you going to go off now?
Yeah. I work at a place where we run movies, and the client's sitting there watching a movie right now. It's almost over.
Okay, no problem. Just hop back on when you're there.
Okay, I'll be right back.
One of the things I wanted to talk to Greg also about is he did a book called Weird California, and since I also kind of basically did a book on Weird California, I thought we would bond on or at least my home state. I don't know if he's from the place, but I've been thinking a lot about California lately because I've been doing more research on Jack Parsons, the JPL scientist who was also head of the OTO briefly and did a lot of wild rituals with L. Ron Hubbard, and it's just such a crazy story, well told inside the occult community. If you're interested in the occult in the 20th century, there's no way that you haven't, you know, come across and thrilled to the story. And one of the things I was thinking about was that if that didn't happen, and you wrote the story of Jack Parsons like as a novel, it would be absurd. It would be too perfect. I mean, come on, this guy works for the aerospace industry, but he's a magician and a polyamorist and hanging out with science fiction writers, and he meets the future founder of a huge nefarious Gnostic cult, and they invoke some entity out in the desert by these power lines, and then he blows himself up in a lab. I mean, it's crazy if you wrote that story, but it happened. You know, that's that part where you get into the poetics of this stuff. I mean, that there's an element of it that's irreducibly, like, you don't need to say anything. It's like the poem's already there in the story.
it's the miracle of the impossible, you know, like with some of these stories, it's just there's too many impossible things that happen along the journey to deny that kind of mysterious, mystic, godlike, alien connection of something extraterrestrial. It's just the supernaturality of it in those extraordinary stories is what really sticks out, you know?
Well, there's also the sense that they are, like I use the metaphor of a novel, but I mean it kind of self-consciously, that there's a sense that in engaging with this stuff, we're not just writing and reading about it, because that's a lot of what we're doing, talking, writing, and reading, you know, when we're not actually in those rare moments when something genuinely anomalous happens. But it's also that something is writing and reading us. That there's an element of deep story that's going on, and that when you start to look at this stuff, it's not just that you're getting closer to the mystery of whether or not there's the Yeti, or whether or not, you know, the ancient Mithraic mysteries were conjuring up UFOs, but it's almost that material is structured like a story, like a deep myth, and that you can, it encourages you to read it symbolically, the way you'd read a poem, as much as it encourages you to try to figure out whether it's true or whether it actually happened exactly the way that it was. There's sort of a poetic logic that takes over. I mean, you know, you're a great reader. How do you see the relationship between all the research you've done with books and that world of anomalous experience that in some ways the books are about?
Oh, it's almost always directly connected, because often when I do research on some kind of paranormal thing, I find that the passage that I'll find that I read, that for whatever reason I pick out to read, directly relates to some experience I just had. So I constantly have a synchronistic experience when I do the paranormal research, where it reflects an event that's happening in my life. And that's where it kind of shifts to a relationship with that, like you were talking about, when that inside and outside become connected, and that can happen through reading and research. It totally happens to me all the time.
Yeah, it's really a remarkable effect. I mean, I've been thinking about it a lot in terms of Philip K. Dick, because Philip K. Dick's works have a lot of sort of magic books in them, and people are like opening books at any page, sort of like the way he used the I Ching to inspire the plot development in The Man in the High Castle. And he himself was very aware of this kind of magic potential of writing, and I've had a number of really wonderful synchronicities involving his texts. And I just had one the other day, because I've been working on some of the exegesis material for a book that's going to be coming out, an edited volume of the exegesis. And I was transcribing this passage, and he was talking. He's, you know, one of the many things that he's obsessed with is this this word Felix that appears in Flow My Tears, and the policeman said, and this becomes an elaborate in his fantastic imagination. It becomes this trigger signal for this whole kind of Christian Gnostic truth or message that's actually coming through the book. So it already has that sense of the living book. Anyway, I'm transcribing it, and one of the translations of Felix is happy, like, you know, felicidad, and and just as I was writing the word happy, right after I wrote it, I like hit some weird combination of keys, and I produced a little happy symbol, which I have never done before, and I have no idea how to do it. Like, whatever combination of keys gives you a little happy symbol. And even on that trivial level, it was so hilarious. I just like burst out laughing. There's this sense of the magic of texts, of writing stories.
Totally. Like, there was even one experience that I had where it was literally like I had seen a bat, like, right up close for the first time in, like, ever in L.A. I mean, I never see bats in Los Angeles. And then, like, the next day, the first book I pick up, I open it right to the page that's talking about bats.
There's tons of bats in Los Angeles.
I know, but I've never seen them.
I see them all the time, but then I look for them because I like bats.
I love bats.
Is there a certain place where they congregate, Greg?
I don't think so. I mean, they got to be near a place where there's a lot of insects, because that's what they eat for the most part, at least the ones in Southern California. So, yeah, I think they like to be near water. But, you know, I've seen them. I'll tell you a weird experience. I play softball and I pitch, and one time my pitching was going really bad, and I got so frustrated I looked up in the air, and right as I looked up, a bat flew over. Right after that, my pitching got totally. I started laughing to myself. I mean, if people could see me laughing, they thought I was going nuts. And I didn't say anything about it to anybody. But right after that, everything was fine.
Okay, well, I'm glad we're talking about bats in Los Angeles, because I definitely wanted to talk a little bit about Weird California, the book you came out with some pals a couple of years ago. What was it about that topic that drew you? I mean, talk a little bit about as a fellow Californiana freak, I'd love to hear you talk about what California's meant for you as you've gone down these weird and wonderful roads.
It's funny you say that, because I was thinking heavily of moving. I was born here. But I was thinking heavily of moving out of California at some point, especially L.A. because of the traffic, et cetera, et cetera. So I've been here in L.A. proper since 81 or 2. But after I wrote the book, I decided I don't want to leave. I like it here. I mean, I was born here. I like it here. And when I started going and looking at all these great places and weird things that I knew were here but never had experienced, I decided to stay. The way I got... I wasn't going around asking people if I could write a book on California, about weird stuff in California. There was a guy named Paul Young who wrote a book called L.A. Exposed a few years ago, and I had done – actually, he came to ask me about Jack Parsons and a few other things, and I talked to him about that, like, in the 90s sometime. And he had been tapped to write that book, and he said, well, no, I'm working for a Hollywood Reporter or Variety now. I don't have time, but there's another guy maybe who would be good for it, and he suggested my name. And so Mark Skirman, one of the editors, wrote to me and said, are you interested? And I said, hell yeah, I'm interested. I get to write a book about where I live and all the great weird stuff here, of course. I mean, what would you want more than to be paid to do something exactly what you want? So that's what happened. They just said, you know, what do you want to write about? I sent them about 50 ideas, and they said, okay, here's 40 we like, and here's 30 more we want you to work on. So I got to go to haunted houses and interview people about them, and I got to go to abandoned metal and hospitals and tuberculosis wards and wander through them, and not at night because I didn't want to run into anything or hurt myself, but... and graveyards and Death Valley at Racetrack Playa, where the moving rocks are. All these places I always wanted to go. I had a reason besides just wanting to go there. I was assigned to. So, you know, it was just, for a little while it was a dream come true. So now I'm, you know, trying to reclaim that again. And then, you know, working this job here at Technicolor to do to pay the bills until I get some more book and article income.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's really like I had the most marvelous time doing very similar research for The Visionary State, and I made a vow to go to every place that we talked about in the book, and there's still a few of the sort of somewhat more challenging places or for other reasons I haven't been to. But in a way, that's okay, because it means that I will be impelled to see them at some point, you know, fairly nearby. But there's nothing like having to go on a pilgrimage. You know, it's like for people like us, it's like a modern pilgrimage where, you know, yes, I can just go to some, you know, interesting place just to kind of entertain myself. But when you got to go there and you have to ask people, you get to meet people, you got to get some information, you have responsibility to try to articulate something about the place, to be true to the place.
Yeah, it makes it 100% better.
It's really a nice experience.
It makes it so much better. I mean, I went to the Whaley House, if you know what that is. It's in San Diego. It's one of two official, recognized by the state of California, haunted houses in the state. The other is the Winchester House. And I had talked to, before I was even working on the book, I actually went and talked to somebody sitting in the front, one of the caretakers or whatever, people that run the tours or take people's names or whatever when they come in. And I said, have you seen anything here? And she said, oh, yeah. I mean, I've had somebody touch me, and I've heard footsteps upstairs when nobody's in the building but me. And he said, well, how about this? And he showed me the log book where you're supposed to write, you know, each person on every shift writes down anything significant that happened or, you know, I checked these doors or whatever. Practically every page had something on it.
Wow.
It's like, oh, I smelled cigar smoke. There was nobody here. I saw a guy walking up the stairs. There was nobody here. One of the patrons came running down the stairs terrified. You know, everybody that works there has had some experience. So then when I went back, I asked to see the book again, and they showed it to me, and they also let me sit upstairs by myself after they had closed near Halloween. And I just sat in the upstairs, and nothing happened, except when I said, okay, forget it, and I started to leave. Immediately hit with a wave of lavender perfume smell, which is one of the things that happens. And there was nobody up there, nobody spraying, unless they had a like spigot in the wall or something, I suppose could happen. But you know, why did that happen? Well, unless somebody's watching me, you can make up all kinds of conspiracies about it. But as soon as I got up and said there's nothing here, you know, after 20 minutes, that's when it happened.
That's so amazing. Actually, I went there when I was a little kid, and when I'm glad you brought it up. I hadn't thought about it for years. I remember it was almost like I was already having this conversation we've been having, you know, this whole hour, where I remember like, okay, it's a haunted house, and I was probably like 8 or something, and like, and I went in there and I was like, okay, it's going to be like weird. And I remember like almost sort of encouraging some weird experience. And then suddenly like I kind of saw something and I was like, yeah, and I got all spooked out. But then at the same time, even then I was like, yeah, but maybe I'm just like making it up because I want it to be haunted house.
Yeah, well, I wasn't making up that
which
smell.
Which is another
like
side
said,
of that
could've.
Kind of story is like watching yourself kind of want and then turn away and then to have it come through that way. That's a marvelous little story.
You know, it should happen that way because if you know anything about psychic research, research into ESP and all that and a lot of, you know, dyed-in-the-wool science types hate this. But what seems to happen is when you open your mind up and are not saying this isn't going to happen, that's when it happens.
You invoke it.
Yeah, you invoke it just by knocking that wall down of, you know, I don't think it's going to happen, or you know, this isn't possible. I mean, it sounds stupid. It sounds like you're encouraging wishful thinking, belief type thing. But that isn't it. It just seems like the less skeptical somebody is, the more likely they're going to be blown away by something that would, you know, would have blown them away even if they were skeptical.
Yeah.
Your story that happens also over and over again in that type of research.
What's that again?
That happens over and over again in that type of research. They used to say that about Uri Geller when he was touring the United States in the 70s and put off in Targ and people like that. And people at many universities were testing him. If there were people in there giving him a hard time, it wouldn't work, and he would start making stuff up and then make it even worse because, you know, the people would catch him at it. But if people were, you know, willing to just sit there and let something happen or, you know, basically have an open mind about it, open-minded meaning not believing it's going to happen but just saying if it happens, if something happens, it's amazing, let's take a look at it, and if it doesn't, then it doesn't. In other words, a purely skeptical attitude rather than a fundamentalist skeptical attitude.
Yeah, that is a wonderful that distinction really needs to be more clearly clarified. You know, it's funny. I have
an
example of the same kind of thing, although in a very different domain, which is around the issue of animal intelligence and particularly the ability of you know chimpanzees to use language. And you know it's actually quite a roiling debate at this point. More and more, you know, animal scientists say, look, yes, clearly they have capacity to actually generate what we think of as language, to come up with creative statements, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, there's quite a lot of skeptics who are kind of influenced by behaviorism. They say, look, these animals are just learning how to, you know, you're just training them. They're not actually doing anything. And it's quite you know, it's quite vexed argument. And what's interesting is it's the same kind of thing happens. If you walk into a room with some bonobo chimps and you're like, hey, maybe I can have a conversation with these guys. And you're like, hey, guys, what's up? How you doing? They're going to, like, talk to you. But if you walk in there and you're like, these are, you know, stimulus response machines produced by genetic evolution that want food from me, they're going to be like, whatever, I'm not going to talk to that guy. It's no fun. So there's definitely a kind of agreement without belief that we're talking about, that let something happen.
Yeah, that's a good phrase, agreement without belief. And if you don't even want to go that far, like just like I said, a true skeptic. I am unconvinced, but if evidence, you know, if compelling evidence comes up, I will consider it instead of saying there isn't any evidence and disproving it, because that's basically that's belief, actually. Disbelief is also belief. you know what I'm saying.
It's funny because actually the first chimpanzee that they taught sign language to, one of the biggest skeptics that they couldn't learn a language was Noam Chomsky, and so the first chimp that they taught sign language to, they named Nim Chimpsky.
Yeah, well, that's you know that's perfect. You see, this is a phrase like I said about fundamentalist skepticism. People use debunking. You're just a debunker. It's like, well, there's a lot of bunk. So debunking means just taking the bunk out of it or showing everybody that it's bunk. And skepticism has been hijacked by people who are not skeptics or fundamentalist skeptics.
Yeah.
They have a certain idea of the world, and they're not curious about it. They're defending a faith in many cases. They're not trying to advance knowledge or be purely inquisitive as people should be and as a scientific method should be. Yeah, there's a lot of bunk, but there's a significant percentage of stuff that people routinely ignore, and I think it's that's just the way people are. People have this. There's a psychology of being right. There's a William Burroughs quote. Yeah, the mark of a. Can I swear on this show?
I don't think so. I prefer not to.
Okay. The mark of a basic. It starts with an H and ends with a T. Is that he always has to be right.
It's funny. It's like I obviously I've come across red skeptics, self-proclaimed skeptics, seen talks, etc.
Oh, I do.
But
too.
I've never really gone into their world like deep, like actually really go like behind the pages of Skeptical Inquirer. Like, what is it actually? And I started listening to some podcasts, and I was tracking like Conjuring, and I was looking at Stage Magic, and there were some interesting interviews or whatever. Mm-hmm. And what blew me away is they were so religious in their style. They were an embattled minority fighting against the forces of darkness, having to, bond together in this sort of wink-wink way, and it was like this whole narrative that was so clearly religious in its emotional quality and its sense of the world, and it just blew my mind because I was like, this is so far away from what I think of as being, skeptical in the sense you're talking about. It's almost like we need another word. Because it's hijacked. It's hopeless. You're never going to get debunker or skeptic back from that.
Yeah, I try to use fundamentalist skeptic as the type of person we're talking about, as opposed to skeptic, or maybe even the word zeteticist or zeteticism, if you know.
Whoa,
about that.
Whoa, what's that?
It's a truer form of skepticism, in my view, which means that they don't believe anything. That they don't believe it's a philosophy where you don't believe anything and you don't disbelieve anything. Just look it up on Wikipedia. Look up zeteticism and look up the Pyrrhonist, Pyrrhonist. That is what I think true skepticism is, which is take each case on its own merits and apply the same methods to it. How much proof do we have for this? So you've got either proved, disproved, or you don't have enough information yet. And a lot of this UFO and paranormal stuff, I think, falls into the don't have enough information yet. Not disproved. I mean, not enough information, therefore false. That just shuts down debate and shuts down questioning and shuts down any kind of understanding we could have about something, even if it's just a psychological understanding. But keeping the options open so that when you say something, not enough information to make a decision yet, that leaves the door open for further research and further inquiry, which saying, the popular version of skepticism, like you see on TV and in Skeptical Inquirer, is, this is full of crap. Let's prove that it's full of crap. We already know it's full of crap.
Exactly.
Instead of just saying, this looks interesting, but it hasn't proved itself yet. So let's just keep it in the maybe box for a while. There's very little room for any maybe box with most people.
Right, and again, that's what the excluded middle was all about, and I really appreciate you articulating. It's really, for me, this is a very important key to thinking, to being in the world, and for me, it's not just about being more honest, or even allowing the world to be more interesting, because, of course, it's a wonderful key to making the world more interesting and more open-ended. But I think it's ultimately an ethical and even to some degree spiritual principle, in the sense that it forces you to not hold on to conviction, to really try in any case with this person, with this story, with this bit of evidence, with this claim, with this experience, to have this radical openness that's still intelligent, that's still willing to be critical or to consider why, but at the same time not rushing in already with an explanation or a box to put something in.
Well, I think we're blinded by our culture and blinded by or at least tracked, I don't know about blinded, our education, our background, our experiences, and something people don't really think about or talk about much, our language. In the way we see things, the way we talk about things, the way we conceptualize things, it is ruled by the way we talk about it. If we don't have a word for it, or we don't have a word for that emotion or that feeling or that concept or that vague thing that you can't put into words, then it just doesn't exist and it's not discussed. And I think other cultures and maybe other mindsets, whatever, don't have as much of the a problem with that. Not saying that they're better, but they're aware of different things. No, you know, Hindus didn't build an atom bomb, but I think that the way that Indian scientists go about things, and even Chinese scientists at this point, is different and maybe more fruitful at this point than the way a lot of Western scientists look at things.
That's a wonderful approach. You know, Greg, we got to leave. I wanted to mention before we take off that you can check out some of Greg's stuff on theexcludedmiddle.com and also UFO Mystic, which is a group blog that he posts to. And he also has a radio show, Radio Misterioso. Anything else you want to throw in there, Greg?
No, thanks for mentioning all the stuff. And, yeah, if you want to go to RadioMysterioso.com, you can download many of the shows. And UFO Mystic has a lot of my columns, and I explicate all the stuff we've talked about, including tons of other stuff, if you want to read it and comment on it.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Greg, from Maja and me on Expanding Mind. Keep your minds open.